Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined, as always, by my colleague, Stuart Mandel. Stu, we got a fun podcast today. We got a big, big-time guest, the busiest person we know. Who is it?
I'm so excited. We have Holly Rowe from ESPN on the podcast this week. It's going to be a great conversation, and then we're just loaded with good listener emails to answer after that.
Okay, Stu, we're pleased to be joined. We have a special guest today, as we mentioned. It's the great Holly Rowe. Holly, before we get into the massive workload you have as a sports reporter, a lot of people know about your battle with cancer. How are you feeling now, and what's the latest with it?
Oh, thank you for asking. I'm doing great. I literally just feel like myself for the first time in 4 years this month. So I'm almost, I finished chemo last August. So I'm nearing that 1 year anniversary, and I've had a couple of good stable scans. So in the cancer world, they just kind of scan you and make sure nothing is developing, and you just pray that you kind of go into remission. So I think I'm getting close to that, but I feel good. It's amazing. I'm like, wow, this is what it feels like.
A lot of, that's good to hear. A lot of our listeners obviously know you for your work on the sidelines in college football, and we're going to get into that a lot. But just from talking to a couple of your colleagues, I talked to Joe Tess this week and also talked to Fran Fraschilla. One of the things that comes up is Holly is always moonlighting. It's almost like they'll be in a hotel room and they'll be like, wait a minute, she's doing a game right before our game, where she's, you know, when she's at an event, she's like, hey, I have a couple hours to kill. I'm going to drive over and watch Georgia Tech's practice, or I'm going to go do this and that. How have you been able to keep this pace that you do? But also, you know, for Stu and I, we just cover college football. How are you able to just keep engaged and stay so connected to so many other sports while you're in the middle of college football, which obviously has long, you know, deep rosters and lots of coaches and personnel and training staffs and whatnot? How do you balance all that?
It's interesting. I don't know if I do a great job balancing everything, other than I'm a fan of all the sports that I cover. So in my free time or spare time, it's like I'm reading up on this great beach volleyball duo that's probably going to be our next Olympic beach volleyball duo, and then I get to cover them in the NCAA championship. So I've already kept up on them all year because I'm actually interested in them. Or I think this might have been my most diverse year ever, and that's saying a lot, just because I did so many different championships and different sports. I think I did 7 or 8 different sports in the last 3 or 4 months. Like gymnastics, I love gymnastics. I follow it as a fan. And so then when I get assigned to do the NCAA gymnastics championship, I'm kind of already up on everything. And then you do a deep dive, you know, like you would to prep a game, but you already have this peripheral knowledge. So I guess I am judging myself a little bit right now, because I keep seeing these things like college football season is 82 days away. And I'm like, oh man, I don't know who the offensive line is at Georgia this year. Or, you know, like I definitely know that I have to start doing a more deep dive into my college football stuff right now.
You went through one of the hardest possible ordeals you can go through, and you did it obviously very publicly. And I'm wondering, I'm sure, you know, because of that, you got had a lot of support from people watching, from the people you cover. But I mean, can you just describe what it's like to go through something that's, you know, that's so personal, obviously, you know, as a public figure?
You know, it's so funny. I don't know if you guys and I have ever talked about this, but, you know, I never set out to be like, oh, I'm going to be public about this cancer. And it was just this very weird, organic way that it became public is I had a game on a Monday night. We did Big Monday at Baylor, and I flew back to Salt Lake City and had surgery the next morning at 8 o'clock a.m. And, you know, I just, because it all came together so late and you find out you have a new tumor and you just wanted to get, you want to get it out. So I remember my boss texting and saying, what do you want us to say when you start missing games? And I was literally like, oh, no one is going to notice if I'm missing games. Like literally no one is going to be like, shouldn't Holly Rowe been on this game? So I really didn't take that seriously. But then as I'm in the hospital that morning getting prepped and all these people keep coming in asking me to sign different forms for things, they keep saying, are you the Holly Rowe on ESPN? And I was like, oh, you know, maybe I should say something because people here in this hospital, it's going to kind of be public because people are talking about that. So I literally just texted our PR gal, you know, like two sentences like, hey, just thought you should know just in case anyone asks, I'm in the hospital today. I'm having surgery, blah, blah, blah. Like literally not thinking anything about it. And so then I had surgery. And when I woke up from surgery, I asked my son to put the Tuesday night, I'm pretty sure it was an Iowa State basketball game on in my room at the hospital. And I saw my name go across the bottom line of ESPN. And I was like, wait, did that just say my name or am I coming out of the drugs? But you know, what's happening? And it said Johnny Manziel arrested for alleged assault or something about Johnny Manziel and an alleged assault. And then Holly Rowe undergoes successful surgery or something. And I was like, what? You know, like, I just never thought about how that information would be delivered, I guess. But the long story short is it's been a blessing. Like, whatever was supposed to happen, I believe has happened. I have had so much love and support. But I didn't understand the power of when you go through something publicly, other people who are privately suffering get some kind of strength from you sharing that it's hard for you. You know, so when you say out loud, gosh, this is hard for me right now, they're like, you know what, it's hard for me too. And I just found great strength. And I have this whole little online community of people that I don't know them. We direct messaged on social media or Facebook and, you know, become friends and shared stories. And I hope that in some small way that's helped other people, just like their encouragement and support of me has helped me.
Obviously with the nature of what you're battling and the physical and emotional toll, it's on another level, you know, certainly that's one thing, but I'm curious just because as a reporter and this is something just from, you know, talking to people and reading about you, you've wanted to do since you were like a fifth grade or something. How challenging is it to become part of the story where you're going places and people know you, especially a lot of you've been on, especially in the Big 10, Big 12 country for a long time. So there's personal relationships that go deep, like part of their family. But how hard is it to get adjusted to now you become a story as opposed to reporting on other people?
It's super awkward, to be honest with you. Like, I now have much greater empathy for when I'm interviewing people and they're shy or they're reticent or they don't want to say things. You know, I used to think like, how hard can this be? We're just talking about you. That's so comfortable. You should be comfortable talking about yourself. And then when you're asked to do it, people are asking you questions about you. It is awkward. You don't want to sit there and talk about how great you are or what it's super awkward. So I think I've become a much more patient interviewer in my work. And it's been very humbling because I can't even tell you, I have been at games all over the country, like in the most random of places. And I'll give you an example. I was on the beach doing NCAA beach volleyball in Gulf Shores, Alabama recently. And this couple was walking along the beach, like for their evening stroll. And they saw me and they were like, oh my God, Holly, we've been praying for you. And I just burst into tears, you know, and I'm working because I'm like, how is it that strangers are so kind in their heart that they feel a certain way about you, that they would want to pray for you? And I mean, it has just been unbelievably humbling, but at the same time, it can be awkward. Like, you know, I just burst into tears at every given moment and, you know, people have been so sweet and kind, but it's weird to make it about you.
You mentioned that the surgery was in Salt Lake. I know you're from Utah, but we also obviously had a you know, Nicole Auerbach wrote a really good story in December, I believe, about you and Maria Taylor and living in New York. And I believe you have Southern California. How many different places do you live right now?
It's been a whirlwind. So I was in Southern California because that's where I ended up going and doing the rest of my treatment, was at the UCLA Medical Center. I was there as part of a clinical trial with the top melanoma doctor in the country, Anthony Ribas, at the Bee Foundation. Actually got me an appointment and set me up with him, and they assigned some of his research. So the V Foundation has been helpful to me. But then, you know, I'm from Utah. I still have a place there. I hate to give it up because that's my home. But then, you know, not to be morbid, but there was a time when it wasn't looking good for me, and that, you know, I had a lot of new tumors in my lung, and that's usually a deadly diagnosis. And I was like, my son's in New York in college. Whatever time I have left in this world, I'm going to go be by my son. And so I just decided to do a bucket list and use some of my savings. And we got an apartment here on the Upper West Side. And it worked out that Maria could share with me so she could help some of the costs. And it helped her in her life where she was at that time. So we just did it. And I think it's so weird, but the cancer has really kind of pushed me into gear, so to speak. Like, I think a lot of us are just coasting and we're very comfortable and we set up these very comfortable existences. And one day we're going to go do this fun thing. And I have stopped waiting for one day. Like, I'll give you an example. So Beth Mowins, who's one of our great play-by-play announcers for ESPN, she's getting married the end of June. And I'm super honored that she has asked me to officiate her ceremony. So I've become a pastor. I will be marrying Beth Mowins and her husband, Alan, at the end of the month. And then me and Beth and her husband, Maria Taylor and her husband, and another friend of mine, Leah Villette and her wife, Ashley, my son and Maria's mother are all going on their honeymoon together. So it will be three couples on a honeymoon in Bora Bora, and then me, my son, and Maria Taylor's mom. You know, like, on paper, of course that sounds crazy, but we're like, let's go. We're going to go to Bora Bora. We're going to live a big life and celebrate your marriages.
And so is there going to be some kind of national surfing contest that you'll also be reporting while you're in Bora Bora? Will you actually take some time off while you're there?
Theoretically, I'm going to take some time off. We've all been talking about having a ban on our phones. Like, everybody can be on their phone once a day, and then we're all going to put them in a basket and try to just be present, having fun without worrying about work stuff. But I will tell you this, in Bora Bora, they have the world's oldest wooden canoe race, and it's like 8,000 canoes in the water. And I have for a long time wished I could cover that, but unfortunately it's not happening while I'm there. So I will be forced to take time off.
Okay, Stu. So when we see the 30 for 30 that Holly's going to executive produce, we'll know where you first heard it from. Stu, I'm going to read a quick quote from our buddy Joe Tess. We would all talk about how we're going to take it easy the next day, and she would lie to us. She would go off and be doing a WNBA game the next day. She's outworking us threefold, and this is while she's battling cancer. Joe says this with a lot of respect, but I think he was like, Joe is a grinder. He's off, you know, doing boxing here, and he's into horse racing in addition to all the football and some of the college basketball stuff he did. And all these people I talk to, you seem to be hands down the hardest working person in our industry. I had read a really cool story about you, and I think the woman's name was Shelley Thomas. Is this accurate? When you were in the fifth grade, this is I Want to Be Her. So from the time you're that young, has this played out exactly how, like, I guess it would be like 11-year-old or whatever you are when you're in fifth grade, Holly Rowe would have thought this was going to play out in terms of obviously not the cancer battle, but just in terms of the career path and getting to check off all these boxes and do all this cool stuff?
It really has. I mean, I remember take good at this. I'm good at this. I'm interested in this. And then it would kind of tell you what type of profession you might be suited for. And I remember raising my hand to the teacher and saying, my profession's not on here. My job is not on here. I'm going to be a sports reporter. It's not on here. What do I do? You know, and I just have had this very clear vision. First of all, I grew up obsessed. And when I say obsessed with BYU football. So we were Mormons growing up in Utah, and this was in the era that BYU football was fantastic. And I mean, this is the first quarterback I was obsessed with was Gary Scheide. He was at BYU in like 1976. So I was 10 years old. And from Mark Wilson to Gifford Nelson to Robbie Bosco to Ty Detmer, Jim McMahon, Steve Young, like if you think of all the great quarterbacks and offenses and systems that I saw growing up, that will help you understand why I'm obsessed with college football. So I guess it was two summers ago now, I was cleaning out my garage and I found this box, and it's like old yellow newspaper clippings that I have cut out all of the newspaper stories from BYU's 1980 Holiday Bowl win. And to this day, as a 50-year-old woman, I still have those newspaper clippings. And I don't know. I'm like, that's just who I am, as like a kid that grew up absolutely obsessed with sports. And now I'm a woman that is getting paid to be obsessed with sports. And I'm just like, sometimes I just pinch myself. Like, do they know I would do this for free? Like, I can't believe they're paying me.
Well, I maybe was in the same story. You had credited Lavelle Edwards, a legendary coach at BYU, for how he treated you, especially in a, you know, in an era where it wasn't that common. And now I feel like if you grow up or you watch college sports or sports in general, it's not uncommon to see female broadcasters. Back then it wasn't. So what was the environment like when you really got traction in the business and were coming up in it? Not in the last few years, but, you know, in the earlier days of your career.
Yeah, no, this was like 25 years ago. And, you know, this is how long ago it was. It's Steve Sarkisian, who's now the offensive coordinator at Alabama. I covered him as a quarterback, as a college quarterback. I covered his team that went 10-2 and ended up going to the Cotton Bowl, one of the best seasons BYU had ever had. And so the thing that I really credit is Lavelle Edwards and Fisher DeBerry, who was at the Air Force Academy at that time, legendary coach at the Air Force Academy. They never batted an eye and never treated me like a woman or like different. They were just so kind to me. And Lavelle saw me walk by the BYU football offices, and he was in his office. He'd call me in to come sit down and chat. And they were so nice to me. Now, there were some other coaches that would look at me like, what are you doing? And it wasn't that I was a woman. I don't think it was just like Norm Chow kicked me out of practice many times. Who is that over there? And why is she looking at our practice? And he and I will laugh about it to this day. He'll come over and pretend to kick me out of every practice I ever attend with him. You know, Roger French was an old offensive line coach, like literally one of the best original offensive line coaches ever. And I think he didn't necessarily know what to do with me, but he was very nice and he would talk to me. But I think he was like, why do you want to know about zone blocking? You know, like what? Who is this woman that's obsessed with the offensive line? So I just really am grateful. And Ron McBride, I don't want to leave him out, at the University of Utah. I was a student in college and would go do stuff with Ron McBride at the University of Utah. And he was great to me. Rick Majerus was my original basketball coach. And I took coaching basketball from Rick Majerus and got an A. So I mean, there was this generation of people that could have been, you know, sexist or whatever. And I'm just lucky that they were inclusive and kind to me and took time. And I remember Rick Majerus telling me, he's like, you work your ass off. If you work this hard, I'll help you with anything. And he wrote me a recommendation letter that I think helped get me my first internship at CBS Sports in New York City. So I really credit Rick Majerus for kind of being an instrumental piece of my career.
To that end, so Bruce has been pulling up all these quotes. By the way, I've never seen Bruce prep more for a podcast interview than this one, Holly. He's been doing interviews to get ready for the interview. So I'm struggling to keep up, to be honest, but I keep defaulting to the story Nicole wrote. And there's a segment in there, or there's an excerpt in there where you and Maria talk about, you know, kind of how women sometimes get pigeonholed into certain roles, and obviously being a sideline reporter, you know, has limitations. We hear from you maybe 30 seconds at a time. So first of all, I'm glad you have that SiriusXM show now, so we can hear you 3 hours a day. But this all came up in the context of that you and Maria last preseason went on this road trip where you visited a lot of different campuses in the South during preseason camp for a show I guess you guys, it was online, right? It was a show that you guys would then post on your...
Yeah, it was just digital. It was all just digital. And she and I had kind of pitched the idea to some of our bosses, and nobody was really interested in it. And so we were like, you know what? We're doing it anyway. So we went and we would hire the video coordinator at Clemson or Miami, and we would pay them just out of our own money. And they would help us edit whatever stuff we shot at each campus. And then we just posted on social media and on YouTube. And I think in 4 days, we got something like 2 million impressions.
Wow.
And when we got back to Bristol for our college football seminar, one of our bosses said, wow, I feel like we missed an opportunity here. Why don't you guys tell us about this? And we were like, we did, you know. So to their credit, to our boss's credit, we're doing it again this year. And they're getting behind us. And ESPN is going to air it. And I think they've sold a sponsorship for it. And I just really am very grateful for that, because if you look at the landscape of shows, and this is not a knock on anybody, it's just an observation, is every time you turn on a sports show or a football show, it's two white guys talking about college football, right? I mean, almost every single show. And so Maria and I just would start texting each other, look, another show with two white guys. I wonder what that means. You know, and so it's just a way of opening our eyes and other people's eyes. There are a lot of diverse people that can talk about college football. Like, I can promise you, I have a depth of knowledge and a database on college football that is maybe unrivaled with men, let alone for a woman, just because I've lived it, you know? And so it's just like, hey, think of us. We'd love to talk college football with you. Like, just raising our hand over there, like, hey, think of us. And it's not in a negative way of like, you know, why aren't we including more people? It's just more of a, I'm having FOMO. Invite me to the party. I want to talk with you guys about college football. You know, I think that's how you and I, all of us, Stuart and Bruce, our relationships have kind of been of like, I see you guys on the road. I'm like, oh, I want to talk to you about da-da-da-da-da. And we go on and on and on about stuff we can talk about, right?
Absolutely.
So like wanting to be part of it.
I saw it firsthand. I think the first time I met you was at we were both on a mock selection exercise that the people at the playoff did. And you basically were the leader of the room. I don't know who was the... Maybe an Andy Staples was appointed as the quote unquote chairman of the committee, but you led the room. And I just remember thinking, man, what people aren't getting to, you know, people on TV aren't getting to see the full Holly. So you already answered the question I was going to follow up with, which is, are we going to see a sequel of the road trip? And it sounds like we're going to see an even bigger version of it.
Yeah. And our bosses were cool. They're like, we don't want to get in the way. We don't want to micromanage you. We want it to be down and dirty and fun, just like you guys were last year. So we have a ton of leeway and freedom. But what we're doing, she and I are actually getting together tonight in New York City to kind of plan it of what do we want to know about college football? You know, so as you guys are planning your seasons, how do you decide, here's what I want to know, here's what I want to dig into more?
I mean, just as, you know, Stu and I think, approach things a little differently and how we cover the sport. But one thing that I feel like, and this is not intending to give The Athletic a huge plug here, but one thing I feel like, and we're all at similar stages of our careers, we're not 24 years old or anything like that, but the way I look at it is, there's a lot of things, people want to watch the games, they want to, I feel like there's an element of celebrating some of the great things you see that intrigue you about the sport. Now, whether that's the people in the sport or something about the actual game itself, I feel like if you can reveal that to the audience, whether it's viewers or readers, I feel like they're going to really want that stuff, because it's stuff that is harder and harder to find. And I think some of that, and look, Holly, I feel like, you know, you're great at this with especially with access as well. It's like you can take somebody somewhere where they just can't go, and they're trying to find any way they can into the sport. And the more ways you can do that, I mean, the better you're going to be at serving them. And obviously it changes year to year with who you want to cover and how, you know, how, what your approach is, because, and this is something Fran kind of referenced the other, when I talked to him yesterday, was, I don't know how many games you probably do for Kansas basketball over the course of a big Monday or, you know, of a big 12 schedule. He said, but once you get into like that seventh game you've done of Kansas, it's not like necessarily college football where there's a, you know, you have a longer schedule. It's like, how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it, you know, beyond just the game? You can't retell the same story. And that's one of the things he really was effusive in, and your ability to kind of connect with people and to keep, you know, peeling back the onion. And that's the thing that I think, that's the challenge for all of us, I think, as we do this, is to not get stale and to keep people engaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought, like, so one of the things we did last year on our road trip that I was kind of proud of and it was cool was, you know, we went to Clemson, and I think it was their second or third day of fall camp in August. And we see this kid, you know, we've read all about all the wide receivers and, you know, T. Higgins and Amari Rodgers and blah, 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 blah. And we see this kid and we're like, oh my gosh, Justin Ross is freaking unbelievable. And so in August, day three of camp, Maria and I do this little segment about Justin Ross. So you fast forward to the national championship game where he's having these one-handed grabs for Clemson and just really kind of having a coming out party on the national stage. And I just have this moment of pride of like, it makes me happy that I saw something special in this kid and we started talking about him because of an observation in August. He'd been on campus for just a couple weeks, you know. Or another cool story we uncovered with Clemson was that Christian Wilkins, you know, their defensive lineman, who's all everything and that I could not love more as a human, to earn money in the summer because he and his buddy decided not to turn pro and not get millions of dollars. He started becoming a substitute teacher to earn extra cash before the college football season started. And one of the classes he would sub for was kindergarten. And so we ended up doing this thing, and Maria did a big thing on it in one of her games about Christian Wilkins at, you know, 6'3", 246 pound, huge kid as a kindergarten teacher. You know, and I just think these are some priceless stories that you can share with people.
No doubt. And it's you know, you asked about prep. Like, you know, I know Bruce likes to make a really exhaustive preseason camp tour in August, and we watch the Big Ten Network because they go to every single campus in that conference during preseason. So, I mean, I can't even imagine how, in addition to being just great content, I can't even imagine how valuable that tour you guys do is for getting stuff to file away that you can use throughout the season.
Exactly. Let me ask you a question that I've been wanting to ask both of you, and just how do you stay up on stuff year round? So do you have a daily routine, or do you have a, like, every day I get up and do X, Y, Z? I would love to learn from both of you of just, you know, how you stay up on everything.
Well, the biggest thing, Holly, is we don't have to follow softball, beach volleyball. We're just totally focused on this one sport.
It's honestly, it's true. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't want to discourage you from this, but like, life on the college football side is a lot easier. Like, you know, for me, there's a couple, you know, some of our peers who cover college football, they also cover college basketball. I haven't covered college basketball extensively in a long, long time or any other stuff. And so for me, it's just, you know, my approach is maybe a little different, but it's like, hey, if I'm walking to the gym every day and it's a 15, 20 minute walk each way, I make a point of trying to call somebody in the sport on the way there and on the way back. Just, it's like, you know, my expression is it's watering the garden. You're always trying to build those relationships and find out more about what's going on. But I can't imagine doing, like, this is a, you know, kind of a little aside. Our first week a couple of years ago, we had a, our crew had a Tulsa, Oklahoma State Thursday night game and a UTEP OU Saturday night game. And it was a challenge. We, you know, we had to prepare for both games at the same time. And knowing OU and Oklahoma State was easy, relatively easy. But the other teams, especially, I hadn't seen UTEP before. It just was really challenging for me to keep some of that straight. And I think people wouldn't appreciate, unless you're in the middle of it, how hard that can be. I mean, I'm a big college football fan and all, but just to keep it straight and keep the detail and all that is so hard. So I think I can't imagine how it would be to juggle all these balls up in the air as you're doing. For me, and I think to speak for Stu, I think it's a lot easier when that's all we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I have prepped. One year I did 5 bowl games in like a 9-day stretch. That's probably the most I've ever done. And it was hard for me because I don't want to mix up. Wait, was the kid that had 7.5 yards per carry, was that the Clemson kid or the Alabama? Look, I don't want to mix up the numbers and the memorization pieces of it. So, you know, I was like, I'm not going to prep for my next bowl game until the last one's over, so my brain can turn the page and be really fresh. But then that puts a lot of pressure on you to quickly prep a game in 48 hours or 24 hours, you know? So now sometimes what I'll do is I'll prep a team. So for example, this week, I'm going to start prepping college football teams, and I'm going to prep the whole Pac-12 over 7 days. And so that's going to be locked into my brain kind of individual teams. And then the next week I'll start on the SEC. And then the next week I'll start on the ACC. You know what I mean? In the Big 12. So that I can kind of get locked in and memorize some of this stuff before the season starts so I don't get it all mixed up.
Yeah, I'm going to be pouring over Athlon and Phil Steele probably for the next couple months. But really, in general, you know, we're kind of spoiled here at The Athletic. We have this whole network of both national and I think about 25 team writers now. So the best way I follow college football or keep up with the sport right now is just to read all of the stories that our staff is producing. It's about as useful, I think, as anything else I could do to prep for the season. You said earlier, we're not trying to shamelessly plug The Athletic, but that is kind of what I just did.
No, I agree with you completely. And I'm not just saying that, but I think that athletics has become one of my lifelines for college football, especially the state of the team. I'm saying that wrong. Tell me how the right way to say it. State of the program. Like, you guys have these series
at
every different school you go through and do these exhaustive state of the team. And I mean, I'm reading those religiously. One, I think the most important thing is I trust your writers. Like, every single person that I'm reading, I have met, I know, I've seen them at games, and I trust them. And so I'm reading their content with this level of trust and confidence in the content, which I think is important. But I just really marvel at what you guys have been able to do and the people you've been able to assemble, because I mean, this is no offense to my company, but I just think you're kicking our butts, and I think your cast that you've assembled is unprecedented and incredible.
That's extremely high compliment. Right after we get off this podcast, I'm going to be sending you a check.
No, I pay for the service. I am a diligent user. I pay for your service. I think I was one of the very first subscribers. Like, I promise, if you go and look at my, like, when I signed up, I think it was in with a day or two of you guys launching. Because I saw the list of people, and I'm like, oh my God, yes, I'm in.
We really appreciate it. So we've kept you a while here. Before we go, Holly, tell us everywhere people can find you right now.
Okay, well, I'm having a cool experience. Saturday, I am hosting a discussion with Caitlin Ohashi, the UCLA gymnast that went viral on mental health at a mental health day in Washington, D.C. And then Sunday on ABC, you can see me doing the Seattle Storm at the Connecticut Sun WNBA game. So those are my next two things on Friday and Saturday. So our WNBA ratings are rocking. They are up. Every game we've done is up by like 63%. So tune in. I've never seen the basketball be better than it is right now in the W. So check us out this summer. It's awesome.
And then you've also got the Big 12 show.
Hey, Stu, quick thing on the Big 12 Sirius show. So early on, I got a text from somebody, and they said, hey, we're launching the Big 12 Sirius station, but would you like to come on Holly Rowe's show? And I was like, sure. And I was thinking to myself, wow, this woman has the same name as Holly Rowe. What a coincidence. Because I was like, why would Holly Rowe be doing Big 12 Radio 2? That's impossible. So, you know, there's multiple Brian Curtises in the businesses. There's a couple of Gary Smiths. I'm like, wow, this woman that's going to be super awkward for her. Not realizing when I get on, wow, this is that Holly Rowe. She's doing this too. Which furthers.
You're like, this woman crazy?
Well, yeah, but this furthers everyone's going, there must be multiple Holly Rowes. And they all sound the same, and they all seem to look the same, but there must be more than one of them, because how are they doing all this? So, Holly,
I think what Stuart said is, like, I have really enjoyed being able to dig into stuff long form. I think that's probably the real reason I did it, is I love listening to radio, and I listen to sports radio all day, every day. So when I got offered the opportunity to try it, I'm not good at it yet, but I promise I will be eventually.
Oh, I've been on the show a couple times. I think you're being modest there. It's you know what you're doing, obviously. So, again, we can't thank you enough for coming on and spending some time with us today. And we look forward to running into you this season.
Can't wait, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly.
All right. I hope everybody enjoyed that conversation. I know we did. She even threw some questions back at us towards the end there. And now we're going to answer your questions. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. I really like this first one, Bruce. It's from Grant in Birmingham. Hey, Bruce and Stu, big fan of the podcast. My question revolves around the percentage chance of a national title in the 2020s question from a couple weeks ago. You remember that one?
I do.
We had some programs pretty low percentages, and he has a bone to pick with one of them. Bruce put Tennessee at 4%, lower than any other program mentioned. While the last 12 years have undoubtedly been a disaster, I think the majority of that can be attributed to two very poor coaching hires in Derek Dooley and Butch Jones. Aside, I would throw Lane Kiffin in there as well, who have not sniffed head coaching jobs since being fired at UT. People like to bring up the, quote, there's no talent in the state argument, but the state of Tennessee has never had more high school talent. Knoxville is only a three-hour drive from Atlanta and 4 to 5 hours from anywhere in the Carolinas. The fan support stadium is no different than any of the other top seven jobs in the SEC. I'm not saying Jeremy Pruitt is definitely the guy, but I think if Tennessee ever hires an above-average coach, there's nothing stopping them from being a top 10 program again. Would love to hear your thoughts.
Well, again, it's one thing to be a top 10 program. It's another thing to be a national title contending program. I think, you know, I'm gonna reference something you said probably last year. I think consistently Wisconsin has proven to be a top 10 program over the last, you know, decade. You would argue, right, that there's a difference between them being a team that can win a national title and being a top 10 program. And I'm not saying Tennessee is exactly that, but I think there is a sizable gap being a top 10 team and a national title team. Also, the proximity is, yes, I get that. But if you look at how, I think of the top 25 recruits in the state of Georgia, Tennessee has one. You know, Alabama, Clemson, Georgia, certainly, they're doing very well in that state. If you look at even the top 10 players in Tennessee's own state, I think Tennessee only landed two of them and none of the top four kids. So, again, the jury is really still out on Jeremy Pruitt. Again, this is a big, big job for a first-time head coach. I don't know if it's going to go the same way as Florida did with Will Muschamp, but, you know, it's tough to learn on the big stage. And again, for people who I think would look at what Phil Fulmer was able to win a national title, they had a lot of good teams there, and certainly, you know, same with Johnny Majors. The landscape's a little different right now. Now, maybe Dabo Swinney and Clemson will fall off, but right now, Clemson and the way Georgia are recruiting, never mind just Alabama, it's much different than what it's been in the past. And I would argue that that's going to make it only that much harder.
So I'm with Grant. And I don't have to be honest, I don't remember what percentage I gave. I know it was higher than yours. But I think Tennessee is one of the 12 to 15 or so schools that has the kind of institutional pieces in place to win a national title. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I don't know if Jeremy Pruitt's the coach to do it, but you know, I think you're underselling a little bit. We're talking 100,000 seat stadium, ravenous fan base. They're not in, you know, some remote part of the country where there's no football talent. There's plenty of football talent around there. The thing that's working against Tennessee right now is when Phil Fulmer had it going in the 90s, Georgia was not what it is today. And so he was able to go into Georgia and get a lot of great players.
And he went into South. Clemson was not
what it is. Clemson was not what it is today. So, you know, can all three of those programs be elite at the same time? That I don't know. But
I mean, you know, all the things you said, you know, the big stadium and everything. I mean, has Penn State won a national title in a long time with a big stadium? I mean, they have a great history of success. It's been a long time since they won a national title. Nobody's upgraded their stadium in the way that Texas A&M has upgraded their stadium. They have a lot more talent in their backyard than Tennessee does. They've had one top five finish in like the last 50 plus years.
Who has more talent in a 4-hour radius, Tennessee or Penn State?
I mean, Tennessee has to Georgia, but again, think about all the people who are in Atlanta.
Yeah.
That's the part of it that I think, you know, yeah, there's some access to talent, but it's not like USC where you're the big dog there. When you look at people who are going to say, let's say it's a kid in Atlanta and the Tennessee coaches come in there, those Tennessee kids, and this kind of references something, you know, a different school point somebody said, the kids who grew up, who are now getting recruited, they don't remember when Phil Fulmer was the Tennessee head coach. They don't even remember when Lane Kiffin was the Tennessee head coach, much less, you know, they had a couple of top 25 seasons under Butch Jones. But it wasn't like this program has any, you know, noteworthy success in their lifetime.
Well, if you're going to play that card, I would point out that the Taj Boyds and Christian Wilkins and Deshaun Watson, the people that were the guys that became the foundation of Clemson's, you know, dynasty, did not remember them winning a national title in the early 80s, you know. Whether you have the pieces in place. So the question,
whether you have the right coaching staff, and that's the question.
Well, that's the number one thing, and I don't know if Jeremy Pruitt is that guy. I'm trying my best to keep an open mind, but the question, just to go back, remember, the question was percentage chance in the 2020s, so sometime in the next 11 years, and we don't know if by the end of that period of time, whether Dabo will still be at Clemson, whether Kirby Smart will still be at Georgia, whether they'll still be winning games at the rate they are now. Tennessee may be two more coaches in by then. I don't know. But I think if they have the right coach, they have a much better than 4% chance of winning a national title.
Hey, so just while we're on this topic, if, and it was relatively close to happening because they interviewed him and had a contract all lined up, if Tennessee had hired Mike Leach instead of Jeremy Pruitt, would you have put the percentage any differently than what you had it?
That's a good question. I might have put it a little bit higher just because I would have more faith in him in the short term than I do in Pruitt. But because he's talking about such a long time period, you know, I really tried not to include coaches in it at all, you know, because we don't know who the coach is going to be 8 years from now. Should we move on to the next one?
Sure. Hey, guys, I'm a lifelong Stanford fan and a Stanford alum who attended the school from 2010 to 2014. So in my 4 years, we were 46-8 and went to 4 BCS bowls and were then one loss of playing for the BCS title in 3 of the 4 years. Since then, Stanford has been very good in 2015, mediocre once, which was 2014, and somewhere in between those 3 times, 2016 to 2018. Looking forward, it's hard to imagine Stanford being consistent top 5 or top 10 program again in the next few years. And given the school's history, it's highly unlikely that they will never be that good again for a consistent stretch like they have for the rest of my life. I'm 26. My question is, how, as a fan, do I cope with the realization that I'll be watching my alma mater for hopefully 70 or so years and may never see them get to that previous level again? Best, that's John from New York City.
That's got to be the most pessimistic fan I've ever heard from. They've only won 9 games or so the last few years instead of 11 or 12, and so he's already ready to write off the next 70 years. So I happen to be pretty well-versed in Stanford right now because I'm literally writing their State of the Program piece as we speak this week. You know, there have been a little bit of cracks the last few years. They're not, you know, that run he's talking about, that must have been an amazing time to be in school there. You know, since then, Washington has gotten a lot better under Chris Peterson, Washington State under Leach, and so they haven't been going to Rose Bowls. They've been going to the Sun Bowl. But they did play in the Pac-12 title game 2 years ago. I think he's underselling it. I mean, I think David Shaw is going to be there for a long time. They do recruit very well. If you look at, as I did in this, their 2016 and 2017 classes, the hit rate's pretty darn high. I mean, the 2017 class had Colby Parkinson, who's, you know, going to be probably an All-American tight end this year, 2 5-star offensive tackles, one of whom, Walker Little, is probably going to be a top 10 pick next year. Paulson Adebo, who was the, I think, 2nd in the country last year in passes defended. So they're still recruiting really good players. Now, there's been a lot of turnover on that staff. Mike Blumgren was the OC and O-line coach for even longer than that. He's now the head coach at Rice. There was kind of a scandal there this spring. Shannon Turley, who had been the strength coach since Jim Harbaugh got there in 2007 and credited with a lot of their success, was fired for reasons that have yet to come out. So it's possible. It's possible that they'll go into decline, but I don't think it's ever, I don't think they're going to go back to Walt Harris days, Buddy Tevens days. I think they'll continue to be a contender.
Okay. Well, I'm excited. I see what they do week 1. I think I might be at the game where they play Stanford. In a matchup of I think KJ Kessler, by the way, is a really good quarterback.
Yep.
And I feel like he gets a little lost in the, you know, Justin Herbert's a guy that has had a lot of draft buzz, and as people have said, Stanford, and John said, Stanford's been, was pretty good last year, but they weren't that good. And I think because it just feels like they've lost a little momentum, and let's see if they can get that back in 2019.
I'm gonna drop a little bit of a scoop for you here right now, okay?
All right.
It's going to be in the story, but I'll just say it now. KJ Costello is a 4th-year junior. When I was interviewing David Shaw for this piece, he just kind of without even, you know, just kind of, you know, one of those things where somebody says it and you're like, wait, did he really just say it that way? You know, referred to him being in his last year. And I said, well, wait a minute. Isn't he a junior? He said, oh, yeah, but there's no chance he's coming back next year. He'll be gone to the NFL. So KJ Costello, likely 2020 NFL quarterback. Okay, back to the podcast in a second, Bruce, but first, let's talk about one of our favorite sponsors, Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy to understand charts and market data and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as the 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of the Audible a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at audible.robinhood.com. Why don't I skip down for a second? There was a question related, you know, you mentioned the Stanford-Northwestern game.
Mm-hmm.
Let me bring up a question, something somebody said to me, and that is David Sharp. You know, remember we were talking about the Northwestern-Stanford game with Derek Crocker. Mm-hmm. He said, "Hi, Stuart and Bruce." I was sure said he was a little bit conflicted over the Northwestern versus Stanford game. I can only imagine what his fellow alumni thought. Bruce, would you be conflicted at all if Miami played at USC or UCLA? Keep up the great work. I wanted to include this just to give people a little bit of a window into, I know that everybody assumes we're, you know, super fans like everybody else and that we've got agendas and we hate your school. I just want to give a little window into this. So, like I said, been working on the Stanford State of the Program. Went there, sat down with David Shaw, the coordinators, Paulson Adebo. And, you know, I'm there probably once or twice a year because they're so close. So imagine then these guys were nice enough to give me their time. They trust me as a reporter. If I then went to this Northwestern-Stanford game, sat in the stands with my friends, wore purple, and rooted for them to lose, that would be so unprofessional. So when I say I'm conflicted, like I'm going to be sitting there on my hands. I hope nobody gets hurt.
Yeah, I mean the same. Look, I think at this point, just from covering the sport for a long time, you know people and where they are, and you know, I think you want to see them do well, but your allegiance to your alma mater, and we can only speak for ourselves in this, in our own individual situations, but you know, you may know a lot of fans at a certain school, you may have a connection to people who work at the at a given school, but I think after a while, you know, at the end of the day, you just want to see really good games,
right?
And that's really all it comes back to. And I know there's you know, a lot of people in the media now who are very open about their fandom of a given team or whatnot. And that's, you know, that's their own prerogative. And I think everybody covers the sport a little differently. And so I think just because, you know, if you see Mike Wilbon is a big, you know, Northwestern guy, or Mike Greenberg's a big Northwestern guy, or Bill Simmons is a big Red Sox guy, that doesn't mean, you know, or you can see, look, I think Dennis Dodd is our friend who covers college football, was a big St. Louis Blues fan. You know, he's
happiest person in America last night was Dennis Dodd.
Yeah.
I've got no problem with people in the media, you know, outwardly rooting for teams that they don't cover. You know, I was unabashed about when Northwestern made the NCAA tournament a couple years ago, because I could be. I didn't cover them or college basketball at that point. But we are national football writers. We have to stay objective.
All right. The next question I got, Stu, here, this is from Jonathan Klein. Stu and Bruce, love the show and your contributions to the sport. Thank you, Jonathan. My question is, what is your favorite books about college football other than ones you have both wrote? Stu, what do you got?
You know, I'm going to go back a little ways on this one, but one of my favorites was Warren St. John.
Jesus, we think alike. This is really sad.
Rammer, Jammer, Yellow Hammer.
Neither one of us discussed this.
And that's yours too, huh?
I have two books I wrote down when I saw this question. One's a college football book. It's that one. The other one is my all-time favorite sports book, and that's Terry Pluto's Loose Balls.
He asked us for football
the
books,
old ABA.
Right?
I know, but the Warren St. John book was
so
mine.
The Warren St. John book, if you've never read it. So Warren St. John, longtime New York Times writer, not a sports writer, and kind of what we're talking about now. So it allows him to remain an unabashed Alabama fan. He's from there. He grew up watching the Bear Bryant coach's show on TV, and so he decides to spend a year. I remember it was the 99 season, because Alabama won the SEC title that year, but they weren't that good. And he spends the year caravanning with the people who Alabama fans who go to the games in the RVs. And it was just a fascinating window into a culture that, you know, I think if you're not there, you can't possibly understand it. It was almost like a it was less of a football book than it was like a sociological book. So that's funny that we both came up with that. Of all the ones that have been written, we both went to that.
Yeah, I mean, that was the one that jumped out at me. I loved that book. I thought, and I didn't know Warren at that time. I know him now, but I just thought it was a fun read, but it was also just a really good insight into the culture down there. And I think you don't need to be an Alabama fan or even really an SEC fan to kind of get sucked into that book. So if you haven't read it, go find it. I'm sure you can find it on Amazon. But he did a terrific job with that.
So this is an interesting one. Mark from Pittsburgh. Hi, Stu and Bruce. I figure that at the end of the 2019 season, we will probably get a whole bunch of wrap-ups for the decade. For example, the All-American quarterback of the 2010s might be Baker Mayfield, Marcus Mariota, or Cam Newton if you were Bruce. Saquon Barkley or Leonard Fournette might be the running back. Which players who would not currently be first-team All-Americans so active players who would not currently be on that list could vault themselves into the discussion with a great season in 2019. For example, I think if Tua has a Heisman or championship season this year, he could potentially surpass those other guys. Who else would be on your list?
Okay. So I didn't have much time to look at this, but I have a couple names come to mind immediately. And what's tricky with some of these guys is you get some guys who are three and outs, and I'm going to name one guy who I think is going to be a three and out, but last year had a phenomenal season, and I expect him to have an equally big year in that. That's Grant Delpit. He's a DB at LSU. He does everything there. He puts up ridiculous numbers across the board. I think he will be, by the end of this year, one of those all-decade kinds of guys I would put in there. After that...
Can I get you one?
You can. Go ahead.
Jonathan Taylor. People may not realize this, but and he could be a three-and-out guy. But here's how productive he's been in his first two seasons. There's an outside chance, I don't think it's going to happen, but an outside chance he could break the all-time NCAA career rushing record in 3 years. That's how productive he's been. So when you talk about great running backs of this decade, and obviously the guys he mentioned like Saquon Barkley and Fournette would certainly come to mind, Christian McCaffrey, but if he has not even necessarily have to break the record, but have another big season, another 2,000-yard rushing season, I would think he'd be one of those two running backs.
I'm going to give you another name of a guy who I think will be there. And there was a little bit of crossover, but I think last year, Jerry Jeudy had a spectacular year. And I think he's in line now. Look, Alabama has three other really good receivers there, but last year, over 1,300 receiving yards and 14 touchdowns. I expect him to have another huge year. So I would say he has a chance to get in the mix on that. I don't know. We saw a bunch of great D linemen last year. Is there anybody you look at and say, okay, this guy has a chance to because Ed Oliver had so much buzz last year going in. Obviously, the Clemson guys did. Anybody else you think is out there that is in line with that now?
Yeah, I feel like all those guys either graduated or turned pro. So when you think about who's going to be the preseason first team defensive lineman, I would assume Derek Brown at Auburn, who everybody was surprised he even came back this season, would be there at defensive tackle. But who are those great pass-rushing defensive ends, like all the guys who, from Montez Sweat and all the Clemson guys and Rashawn Gary, at Oliver, all the guys that were getting the buzz going into last season?
Yeah, I feel like so much of the attention now, you see a lot of guys who leave early to the point where, look, we can look back at Clemson. Xavier Thomas came in, had a really nice freshman year. He's a five-star guy who I think you look at and we're like, wow. Arguably, one of the guys who I think you'll see, because he put up big numbers even though he didn't start last year, was A.J. Epenesa.
Yep.
He's the biggest recruit Kirk Ferentz has had, at least in the star ranking system. Was a double-digit sack guy last year. They lost four really solid defensive linemen. I think they're counting on him to have an even bigger year. But
Chase Young from Ohio State will be getting a lot of acclaim going into the season.
I'm going to stick by my initial pick. I think of the guys out there, and I think your Jonathan Taylor was a good one also, but I think of the guys out there, at least on the defensive side, Delpit's the safest pick to be the one who could kind of put a punctuation on that. And again, it would only be, he had a good first year, but it was a crazy second year, and I think that's what he's in line with for this year.
Speaking of LSU, James Birdsong. Hey, Bruce and Stu, want to touch upon a 2020 recruiting trend that I found interesting. As of now, LSU has the number two class in the 2020 composite rankings. Not terribly surprising given LSU's history of recruiting, but what is surprising is how many of them hail from D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Two of LSU's top three players and four of their top eight are from that region. Any reason why LSU has been so successful in this area?
A couple of things. So they've been successful also in Southern California. What you've noticed here is they have really gone national. And it's something where I think last year they knew that it was a great year locally. So they 2019 class, they felt was a good in-state year. But I think they looked at the map and said there's not as many players. And they felt like they had a lot more reach. I know from talking to Ogeron, he's one of his best recruiters he has is a guy named Bill Bush, who's a veteran defensive coach who got them their best D lineman out of Utah, Apu Aika, last year. And he's had a big role in some of these national recruits. And so I feel, from everything I've heard, is I feel like their message has played well. I mean, they had their best year in, I guess, 7 years there. So, I think they finished sixth in the country. And I think they've got some momentum now. And I think that's what's playing well. And I think also what you've seen, and it's going to be interesting, is that Mike Locksley got hired there. You have a Maryland program that was really mired in a scandal. And Mike Locksley's got to pick up and put together a lot of pieces there. And I think until they start getting some momentum, I think other programs from the outside in, and you're seeing this, are really having a lot of success in an area that really has been picked over pretty good by other programs coming in and saying, come play in the SEC, as opposed to, the success that hasn't been there for their hometown team.
Yeah, I think in general, we talked on the podcast a couple of times now about this class Clemson's putting together that most people think will be the number one class. But LSU's class so far is monstrous as well. Alabama's is really good. I was just looking at the numbers, and I know, none of these guys have signed yet, but on the pace that they're at, you have a potential to have three schools finish with, higher ranked classes than what is usually the number you need to be the number one class in a given year. So really strong work right now coming on from Coach O and his staff. So that's all the time we have for this week. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com, and we'll see you next time.
If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to The Audible on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review while you're at it. It helps get the word out. Thanks to Trader Joe's for being our presenting sponsor. Our producer is Nick Fink. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octave. You can download their music on iTunes and Spotify. Follow me, Stu, at SL Mandel on Twitter, and Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB, and subscribe to The Athletic if you haven't done so already. You can try it for free, 7-day free trial at theathletic.com/free trial. Come on, get over it.